just a matter of time, I suppose.
Welcome to Watchmen Minute, where we're discussing the movie Watchmen from 2009 by Zack Snyder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Eric Nash.
My name's Travis Bowe from the Real Comic Heroes Podcast.
And I'm James from the Fantastic Fools Podcast.
Welcome back, James. How you doing?
Yeah, doing well. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on again. Very happy to be here.
Not a problem. We're glad to have
you. With you guys.
Yeah. And it says minute 92, and it starts with Adrian asking for a name and ends with Laurie not wanting to accept Dan's offer. Oh, come on. Accept his offer. Come on.
Not Al is just adorably optimistic. He's fantastic.
Yeah. So this whole give me a name, I want a name business here, going back to what I was talking about a little bit yesterday, just it doesn't work for me because
his hands in his mouth.
He's clearly covering his mouth while, demanding that he speaks. And we can see that the assassin is pawing at Adrian's hand, like trying to remove his hand, you know. It just doesn't work to me. I don't know if it's bad editing, poor direction from Snyder, you know, bad photography as far as the camera angles, but it just does not work. I think it's...
Well, I guess the thing is that the way you can kind of look at it is that he doesn't actually want to give him a name, want him to give him a name. But
sure, yeah.
So from Veidt's point of view, you know, he just wants to keep this guy's mouth shut. But, you know, potentially the other people in the room can't see that his hand's over his mouth or whatever.
Right.
And he just wants to make sure that he's looking like he's the superhero or whatever and he's doing the right thing. Or maybe they, you know, as long as they think he's just trying to stop him from biting down on his poison capsule, that's what's important, not what essentially the audience views his actions as. It's what the people in the room who are still left view his actions as.
Well, and that's why it works in the book, because the reader and everyone else, like in the space, is basically behind Adrian. So all you see is Adrian's back, and you can hear him saying this stuff. Like, I don't know if the dialogue is completely the same, but he's basically saying the same stuff, you know, give me a name and that kind of thing. And he's got a poison capsule. And then we do see his hand interacting with the assassin's mouth, but his fingers are literally in the guy's mouth, and he's saying something like, you know, don't bite down, you know. So he's trying to prevent him, and he's trying to like dig the capsule out of his mouth, or at least that's what obviously we're meant to see as we're reading this. So it works in the book because of the way the audience and the witnesses are seeing it, you know. But here,
So maybe if this was shot from a point of view,
because
give
a little
bit more.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with what he's doing. It's the fact that we're being shown.
You don't
exactly
have a problem with him murdering
doing.
A man?
Well, you know, this guy, you know, he had it coming. It's just self defense.
Yeah.
It's just I think this is probably the worst thing in the movie for me.
Wow.
Is it something where you know, they said, you know, you just put your hand there, put it over his mouth just to do something. We're going to come back later and kind of make it more detailed and have probably even someone else's hands, like, going into his mouth?
I mean, if it's that, then that's a piss poor
someone reaching behind him like a ghost or something?
I mean, if it somehow got through from start to finish like that, then someone just called in sick that day. So, you know, I think it's just the way that they're showing it to the audience the first time around in this scene is just doesn't make sense. But I'll leave it alone.
It's interesting to me that that's what you think's the worst part of this movie.
It's the one thing that every time I watch it I just shake my head and I don't understand why they do it this way. It's kind of it's as much as they want to hide the bad guy in this movie, this is a complete betrayal of the work that they've done up until now, I think, with that moment. So
yeah, it does make it a lot more obvious than I think they want to.
Right.
Then again, there's a lot of things about Ozymandias that make him, more of a
sure.
Like, maybe that comes down to the source material as well, but like we never see Ozymandias being a hero like in this movie. All we ever see is just being this creepy businessman kind of guy, and that kind of guy is normally a villain. So sure, I think that just by nature of the way the story is told and how Ozymandias is framed, it is kind of pretty easy to predict.
Sure,
especially in the way it's told.
All right. So obviously the hand comes down and we start to see him foaming at the mouth. And then we get the kind of voiceover of the suicide pill.
And actually, just before we get into that, Veidt himself, his acting is really over the top. It's really crazy. I mean, you see the veins in his head.
Yeah, yeah. He's
just yelling.
Yeah, and I like that because it's, you know, obviously Matthew Goody's acting as a man who is acting. And I like how that, you know, Ozymandias himself isn't a perfect actor and he's kind of going a little bit over the top. And there's a few notes on his performance that maybe you can give, but I think it's good. I don't like it when in a movie and someone, you know, does a bit of acting and they're as good an actor as, you know, the actual person is. You're like, well, hang on. You got to have some people who's maybe Ozymandias is good at everything, but maybe he's not the best at carrying dramatic weight when in his soliloquies or whatever. But so I like that kind of extra touch that Ozymandias maybe isn't an experienced actor, so he's going a little bit too far.
Sure,
come on, he needed some more improv classes.
Yeah,
yes, and he has a suicide pill.
The security guard as well, just stand behind him. Just that guy's got no idea what he's doing.
Right.
As I said in the last minute, this is a minimum wage worker who just had a bunch of guys, had a guy come in and shoot a bunch of people in a room where he was meant to be protecting, and now his boss is like holding his mouth over the other guy, and it's like, what am I even here for? I don't understand. That guy is going to have a rough day when he comes home and like, How was your day at work, honey? I've got a story.
Yeah, I saw this lady get shot. Lee Iacocca got shot in the head. And
what did you do? You're a security guard. The boss handled it. It was all good.
He had it. Yeah.
Really, I don't know why he pays me.
Well, that reminds me. You said Lee Iacocca getting shot in the head. I was almost ready to say it last minute, but. How many cases in movies or TV shows, maybe other things too, but are people that are real in our world that get killed not in the same way? He didn't get killed. I think he might be still alive if I remember right. I mean, that just seems like a weird thing that we have this alternate universe and we're actually going to show you this instance of this person from our universe that we right. know very pretty well.
Oh, I didn't know this guy was a real dude. What?
Yeah, he was a big deal, I guess, in the 70s and 80s in the car industry.
Chrysler.
Chrysler.
He's the CEO of Chrysler.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, just Googling him now.
And did his own, you know, not did his own TV commercials like your local car dealership or something else. But, you know, he appeared in the Chrysler commercials to kind of stand behind the project.
Did he jump over from Ford, or was it? I think it was Ford that
sounds right.
I'm Googling him now. It seems to be Ford, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I had no idea that guy was a real dude.
Yeah.
And I did find a little mistake here this minute, second 13.
Okay.
The delivery guy, you can see his hair from the looking back up at
Matthew
Good and the cop or security guard. So he has a hat on the whole rest of the time.
In the other shots. Nice. Yeah. Good spot. Yeah.
Did it fall off when he got knocked into the fountain, or is
no,
it
no, no? Not? It's it, he.
It's on in the other opposite look scene shots.
Guys, maybe this movie's not perfect.
Huh?
It's a continuity error. What are we doing?
That's it. We're done here.
Close up.
Yeah.
Close up job.
Anything else as we kind of transition from looking at the assassin foaming at the mouth and dying in the fountain, we transition via the voiceover of suicide pill over to Laurie. So we get, like I said, Laurie says suicide pill, and then Dan says potassium cyanide. And yeah, going back to what we were talking about a little bit yesterday with it's a classic, you know, the cyanide pill is a classic trope almost, or, you know, kind of a often used item in especially spy movies, or I know Dr. No, you know, the first James Bond movie, like one of his first kills is he's fighting a guy who's following him and he takes himself out with a cyanide pill while Bond is questioning him. And then, yeah, like James mentioned, the scene in Captain America, the first Avenger, the Richard Armitage's character is kills himself and then spouts off about the Hydra. So
Skyfall as well.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Javier Bardem's character is a survivor of having taken the cyanide pill and it not working.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting subversion, I guess, of what, mm-hmm. It's the opposite of what cyanide pills usually do, because they normally kill you, and he was not killed.
Right. Yeah, and apparently the movies kind of blur reality a little bit. I don't know if you guys were aware of that at all, but I read that
just in general, or
just in general. Yeah. I read that the pill isn't usually that fast in terms of swallowing a cyanide pill. It is faster when inhaled. Like if you inhale the you know, gas or whatever, the cyanide via your lungs, you will die much faster. But when you ingest it, it can take a while, take a day, you know. But they liked using the pill because it's easy to hide. If you accidentally swallow it, then it can't hurt you. It has to be crushed and it has to be like broken down, you know, and that way it's obviously gets into your system. But yeah, if you can just pass it, if you're, you know, somehow accidentally swallowed that tooth or however they, I don't really know how
A bit worried though.
Yeah. I think it'd be a rough couple days. Yeah. And I'm sure there's instances of that not always being foolproof, you know?
Well, as far as real people though, you're talking about some fictional instances of the pill, of taking the suicide pill. But potassium cyanide itself, the real person on the Wikipedia page for potassium cyanide, for Rasputin.
Oh.
It says he may have survived potassium cyanide poisoning because his stomach acidity was unusually low. So if you know how to, if you're think you might be poisoned by someone with potassium cyanide, do something in order. I don't know what you do exactly to get your
stomach acidity low. Pump your stomach.
Yeah. You got to be basic. You just got to prepare yourself. You got to be basic. So you got to be into all all the most popular things and just have no edge at all. Just be totally basic, and then you can survive the acid pill.
Ah, okay.
Just watch nothing but Friends.
Drink your Frappuccinos.
Yeah.
Wearing your UGG boots.
There we go.
So I've ragged on the last minute and the editing, you know, but I think we have here is an example of great editing, because we see the assassin, you know, he's dead in the fountain, and then we hear her dialogue saying potassium cyanide. So it instantly explains what happened, you know, and we don't know if this happened, you know, a day ago, hours ago, but it serves to take us to the next scene and also shows that there's a passage of time. You know, there's been enough.
It does what a good transition does, is that it puts you in the middle of a conversation rather than at the start. So we don't start with them walking into the diner and then they order their food and then it just starts to, and they, you know, presumably start talking. Did you hear what happened to Vite, you know, the other day? It cuts us in right at the point of the conversation where we actually need to be there and need to be listening, which is, I think, a really good transition in that way.
Yeah. And this is kind of a perfect mirror from what they did with the scene where they find out that Manhattan is on Mars, and then the scene transitions to, you know, Kissinger getting off the phone. And that was, I was talking then about how that would have been another perfect time to say, you know, have them saying, well, where is Dr. Manhattan? And then as he's about to answer, then you cut to Kissinger on the phone and him telling Nixon, like, Manhattan's on Mars, you know, like that. they could have done kind of what they did here in this minute. They could have done as well back then. And I think it would have been a better transition and better use of time. But
yeah, in terms of watching a movie, as many seconds as you can cut. Just individually.
Yeah.
One thing we do get, though, with the transition and it kind of moving away from that scene so fast, we don't really get much aftermath of that attack. You know, who's left alive in the room? We don't really understand kind of what's the situation there. But that's, I guess what they're saying is that's not what's really important. What's important is how it affects kind of the view of this threat on their lives and things like that.
Yeah.
And how it, I guess, ostensibly rules Ozymandias kind of out. That's what it's meant to do in the mind.
Right, yeah, yeah. About
before, I guess some of the framing doesn't quite sell that as well as it could.
Well, and it also serves to, well, Laurie comes over to Rorschach's side when she says then he was right. So I think that helps to kind of bring the audience back to, oh yeah, there's a mask killer conspiracy and someone, you know, coming after all these people. So I think it's good to bring it back to that a little bit, you know.
Through the window where they're sitting in the diner, I'm curious, you know, in next minute, just remember this window, and I'm curious if we're seeing what we see next minute.
Okay.
The people across the street.
Okay.
One thing that is good about this diner conversation is the first from second, I think it's 18 to 33, 34. It's all one take, all one shot. So that initial diner conversation is all framed as a one slightly longer take, which I think adds a little bit to it. And kind of, it's a good way to, I guess, kind of calm the audience down after an action scene. They just get to sit with one shot for about 10 seconds and it's not too furious. They can just settle back into action scenes over. Back to a dialogue scene.
Yeah, that's a good point because they've done that before after the crazy intense alley fight that we saw between Dan and Laurie and on all the knot tops. As they leave the alleyway, it's one long dolly shot where they're walking towards the camera. Camera's moving backwards, it follows them or stays, you know, in front of them the entire way out of the alley, and then once they hit the street, camera continues to back up and continues the continuous shot until we're seeing both sides of the street, you know, we're seeing them framed head to toe, and then they both walk, you know, completely off camera in separate directions. So
I guess part of this as well is that there's no establishing shot for this scene. So I think it's good that you have this kind of long take because it really gets a sense of the location. So they're in a diner, they're kind of having dinner, there's a waitress there. If you kind of cutting back and forth, print shot, reverse shot, shot, reverse shot, it'd be a little bit harder for the audience to actually orient themselves in where are they right now, like kind of thing. So it gives this good setting. Okay, they're having lunch.
That's a great point, yeah. Did you guys notice that Dan's leaving this tip when the waitress brings the change back? Do you notice the George Costanza move that he does with the with the tip?
Yeah, he kind of refigures it. He has one bit, you know, a bill or two down and picking one up, and then he reverses them.
Yeah.
So, was that more or less or less or more?
Yeah, he could have been taking like two single dollars and replacing it with five. Like, I like to think that Dan's a generous tipper. Hopefully he didn't remove $2 and leave $1,
I think the odds are good.
And it's almost like a sleight of hand type thing when he does it. Like, it's a weird motion blur almost when he picks the two up. He, at the perfect second, he drops, you know, one bill. So it looks like it's just seamless. I don't know. It's really weird.
Yeah, and it's a good like little subtle thing because it's, I mean, obviously our main attention's on what they're saying. And it's kind of a good little character thing that just happens in the background.
The line that he says about, you know, this wasn't some lone nut, and it's an organization well funded, well equipped. And I don't know, is he referring to Pyramid? Does he think that they're behind this? And if that's the case, that sounds crazy because, you know, it'd be like saying
Amazon.
But yeah, like FedEx is out to kill Adrian, you know.
Well, yeah, I guess maybe he thinks they're working through Pyramid, or maybe he thinks just that guy's Pyramid costume is a front, but there is just an organization in general. I'm not sure he specifically means it is Pyramid.
Well, the news that just came out, this is going to put it, figure it out when we're recording, but the news that just came out today or yesterday, I think maybe, for Elon Musk.
You said that FedEx is trying to kill us?
No. He's claiming that he has there was one employee at least of Tesla that apparently was committing sabotage.
Oh.
And I think he kind of suggests that maybe it's another company and what he kind of put out.
Hmm.
I don't know if he said it to the stockholders or if he had it in a blog post or something.
Did he say an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us? Did he suggest retribution?
I don't remember that.
All right.
Yeah, Elon Musk just sent out. Yeah, some guy was trying to sabotage the Teslas. Unfortunately, he had a cyanide pill. Tried to subdue him, but I couldn't stop him from taking it. Real mix up in the end, guys. But
oh boy. I love the framing of this shot with the big window that kind of separates the two of them. It just works for some reason for dialogue and to show two sides of the conversation. And even when they cut in for the shot, reverse shot, you know, they can still have the pull it back for the overall coverage. You know, it's a great framing device for scenes like this.
Mm-hmm. I love also how Night Owl's story is not completely correct. He's like, guy was dead before he hit the ground.
Oh yeah,
we saw that he wasn't, but but I like that kind of rumors have spiraled and things are to what's actually happened.
Going back slightly to the conspiracy and who this person was, is if this person who attempted to kill Adrian, is it reasonable to assume that it's the same person that killed Eddie? And now that he's dead, is there no more mask killer on the loose? You know, is it safe to assume that the national nightmare is over?
Yeah, I wonder why. There's not exactly that much in the Vite scene of that would suggest that it's more than one dude. Yeah, there's nothing in that assassination scene that makes me go, oh yeah, this must be an organization. This can't just be one dude who killed the comedian as well.
Yeah, that's why I just. That whole line about from Dan about the it being an organization, just I don't know where that's coming from. So, anything else before they leave the diner?
What else is she saying? Well, she's so they're kind of both coming around to Rorschach's way of thinking.
Yeah, yeah. She says that who'd want to kill us now, and then he says, I don't know, but it's not safe out there, out here. The you know, obviously notable, the diner that they're in is the Gunga Diner. We've seen the blimp balloon a few times now. I think in Adrian's office outside the window, and I think very early on with one of the establishing shots of New York City, there was the big blimp out in the sky. So I looked up Gunga Din because I knew that it was a reference to Gunga Din, but even that, like, I didn't know anything beyond that point. So, are you guys familiar with it at all?
No. So, might need a refresh. What's happening?
The diner that they're in.
Called the Gunga Diner.
Yeah. Gunga Din is a 1890 poem by Rudyard Kipling, set in British India. The poem is much remembered by its final line. You're a better man than I am, Gunga Din, often quoted in the UK in reaction to self-praise. Apparently it's about a British, maybe an officer who has a servant named Gunga Din. And from what I gathered,
Gunga Diner, is that from the straight from the comic, or is that?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Completely.
Yeah. Cause that would probably make sense. I wouldn't think Zack Snyder would be that versed in British slang.
Yeah, yeah. No. I don't know what the connection is. I don't know why it's...
obviously is from UK.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I'm pretty sure when I was younger, pre-teen, early teen, I think I'm pretty sure I saw the movie then, but haven't revisited. The 1939 movie.
Oh, there's a. I didn't know there was a. Mm-hmm. Is it just called Gunga Din?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What's its little mascot? What's its little logo there?
It's a little elephant. You get a good shot of it. As they
leave in the establishing shot. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's got a little GD on its side. Little Gunga Diner.
That's the thing, because I thought it's. Little canopy on top. I thought that was a head, and I thought it was like a dude.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I see it now.
Yeah. Is there an elephant anywhere in the story of Gunga Din, or
I don't know.
It's just the fact that it's taking place in India, so it's an Indian elephant, not an African, is what it should be. Hopefully, it's drawn or whatever, designed correctly.
I feel like the logo is pretty spot on for the book. Let me.
Yeah, because
Dan and Lori are like, it's pretty well mirrored in the book that they are in the diner. They are having a meal and talking about mostly talking about where she'll stay. And I don't think they're talking about because in the book their little meal in the diner takes place before the assassination attempt. Okay. So they're not even actually talking about. Conspiracies or any of that. It's just she's there with him because the government, you know, now that Manhattan is gone, they've basically kicked her out. So it's quite a bit different than we have here in the movie where they want her to stay. They're trying to, you know, get information from her and she has to essentially escape from the base that she lives at. So here, they tell her that she can't live there anymore now that John's gone, and they've frozen her like expense accounts and all that stuff, so she has nowhere to go, no money, and that's what leads Dan to say, well, you know, eventually he finally says, you know, well, come stay with me. So
we get as they're heading outside, contrast between their glasses games. Laura with the very fashionable shades and
Dan, yes, with
just the quintessential thick nerd glasses.
yeah. I love her look here. The little trench coat she's got rocking. We've seen her in that now like twice, two different scenes. So it carries over. It's good continuity considering she wouldn't really have a lot of changes of, you know, attire. And then I like the little black beret she's got going. It's like her in disguise mode, kind of.
Yeah, and it's very much similar to the Marvel disguise, which you see in like Winter Soldier and things like that. It's just they put on a cap and some sunglasses, and no one recognizes it. So it's it's very similar to that, I guess.
Yeah,
I like that superheroes just like have no idea how normal people dress. So it's like they wear sunglasses, right?
Because
it looks dark there. It doesn't look like sunglasses weather.
It's funny that with could these.
Just be Zack Snyder's color grading, though.
Yeah. When I see her in these, I think they're Ray-Bans that she's wearing, which for the time would have been, you know, a perfect choice. But her in them, I don't know why, but I get a very strong Tom Cruise in Risky Business vibe. Like around second 58, 59, just the way maybe she's moving her head as she's talking, it's very, I don't know, it's very Tom Cruise, like I said, and it's kind of weird.
So she says no word from John, or no, I'm sorry, he says so no word from John, and I'm curious just what kind of communication would that take, form of communication.
Well, yeah, based on the script that we read last week, remember they were kind of implying that they were mentally linked in that, you know, with them trying to connect her to some device to reach out to John or whatever. So I'm very glad that got that cut completely. So maybe this line was kind of a holdover from that, possibly, but
maybe just sent her a letter. Sent a letter a couple of days ago. Post takes a while, doesn't it?
Yeah, send her an email.
Well, he has to kind of like, you know, mind telepathy-ish, whatever, telekinesis, write the letter on Mars, and then transport it with his mind into her mailbox.
I think the postman doesn't come to Mars very often. It's kind of a once-a-month kind of thing. And it just reminds me of this great story about these Australian explorers from, you know, the 1800s who would send bet messages back to Melbourne on their great trip through the wilderness, Burke and Wills. And they kept getting like lapped by the mailman, like on their great exploration trek. Like the mailman, like, oh, I'm back. I went from where you came to and back. It took you like 3 months to walk this far. I've just come back and forth in a week. Here's your mail. I'll be back again.
Wow. I like the, I think the real reason why Dan asks about John is that he probably suspects that, you know, she's had no contact with John. I think that would have come up if there had been. So what he's really doing is, well, if John's out of the picture, then why don't you come stay with me? So
yeah, he's very much hoping for a no.
Yeah. And it takes, it's straight back to the flashback in their first meeting. He was smiling at her. She was smiling at him. And then Manhattan appears. And as soon as she set eyes on him, Dan realized, oh, I have no shot with this lady. So I think it's just Dan, like, instantly, you know, essentially, what, that was 77? Was that 77? No. That was like 70. 70. Yeah. So we got a 15-year, like, break where Dan now has a window. You know, it's his time.
He's waited his whole life for this moment.
Right. So I like that he's – I think that's why he asked. I really do. And I just love that on paper, the last thing that we have in this minute, you know, he asks her to stay. She says, oh, no, that's sweet, but I wouldn't want to. I just like thinking that that's where it ends. Like,
yeah, I just don't want to.
Yeah, it's sweet, but I don't want to. I wouldn't want to.
I wouldn't want to stay at your house, mate.
Yeah. So I like ending it right there. So
it is a good spot to end on. Yeah. I like it.
Is that a good spot for us to end on?
Yep. It's on my notes.
Anything else for the minute or anything?
I just want to know where Dan gets his glasses. I need some thick boys.
I don't know. Did lens crafters exist in 1985? Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And well, I don't know. Dan has money, so I don't know where the wealthy shop for glasses.
It's interesting that Patrick Wilson is a very handsome Hollywood man. Like, sure. He seems to be very, very frequently cast as like down in the dumps kind of doughy nerd guy. Mm. And like you actually look at him, he's like, look at that. He's clearly more handsome than I will ever be. What is happening here?
Right.
See how, because obviously Patrick Wilson's returning to the superhero genre this year with Aquaman. So I guess we'll see if that can that'll change up his kind of almost typecasting that you see in a few things.
They just released those images, and I had to really look to see that it was Patrick Wilson.
Yeah, it didn't look like him at all.
Yeah, it didn't help that it was like a side profile kind of shot. So it, you know, you don't.
And your eyes are immediately going to his hair too.
Yeah, so I'm excited to see that hair in action. Yeah.
All fin shaped.
Yeah, I think that's
swimming through the water.
Pretty awesome. So James, what is your history with Watchmen? Have you read the book?
So I actually watched the movie before I read the book.
Okay.
Probably only a couple of years ago. I saw it on Netflix. It's kind of something I've always been interested in. I kind of got into comic books and comic book movies a little bit later than kind of a lot of people. And what I did was basically, I didn't really have a comic shop near me, so there are a few at my local library, so I could borrow them. But they were pretty much exclusively X-Men stories, so I basically grew up on the X-Men and things like that. And later on, kind of in my teens and stuff, started getting into the movies when the MCU started kicking into gear. So I went back and watched Watchmen for the first time. I hadn't read it at that point. I liked it, but I think I'm not a big long movie fan. Like, it takes, and a lot of the times, especially watching Watchmen, I just zone out a lot in some of these dialogue scenes when I, you know, especially when I first watch it, you know, I go, oh, great, it's an action scene. I'm up. It's a flashback. Perfect. I'm interested in this. And then a lot of these dialogue scenes, I was like, oh, so what? He's impotent or something? I can't even. But I, like I said, I've gone back and watched that a couple of times and read the book. I think it is good, but I can see why. It's one of those movies where I feel like there's a couple others that are a bit like it. Say something like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie, where it's
okay.
It's accurate to the book. I think it's the best version we could have gotten, but it's just not great. There's just like a few problems inherent with the adaptation that just hold it back from being great, in my opinion, as a movie. And I think a lot of those just come from the structure of the source material.
Oh, okay. Makes sense. I have very little experience with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, so I can't really agree or disagree with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just saying it's kind of similar in that the movie and book adaptations, they're very spot on, but they're almost too spot on. They don't quite adapt enough and they don't change enough to be an interesting movie and rather than just being an interesting comic book that they have filmed. Which is, you know, it's fraught with danger. If you change too much, you're going to piss off a lot of people. And I think Zack Snyder was very, very conscious of that when he was making the film. Having said that, it's easily his best superhero film.
For me. Maybe. Yeah.
Travis, you really like Man of Steel, right?
I do. I love Man of Steel. And that's not one that I loved initially. That one took a little time to...
Yeah, I got a friend who was like that. He hated it more. He hated it when we came out of it, and then over the years, he's kind of slowly turned around on it, and he really likes it now.
Yeah.
I've kind of stayed on the it's fine since I saw it to now. Like, I haven't changed that much. I like a lot of the way it's filmed, but I just don't find it interesting when two people who can't get hurt punch each other for half an hour.
Sure. That's fair.
Yeah. That's why I prefer something like, you know, the Daredevil TV series or something. I prefer when I can actually see that the punches are actually doing something to the people in the fight and not just the buildings.
I get that. I always wince and get a little too concerned in like a Man of Steel or movies like that where I start to see buildings get torn apart because I have a hard time like separating real world and you know stuff like that and thinking those buildings are full of people and it makes me really tense up and nervous and so that's definitely a factor. All right, let's see one more time, hit our listeners with your show and where they can find you.
Cool. So my show is Fantastic Fools Podcast. We talk about movie, TV news, and then we do a topic of the week. So we'll talk about a big movie or a movie from our childhoods or just another funny topic that we can think to lay our hands into. The podcast is on iTunes and Podbean and most podcast places. The best place to go is our Facebook page. So go to Fantastic Fools on Facebook. We post podcast links and articles that we post, kind of satirical looks at especially comic book movies and things like that, and a few memes and stuff as well. So Fantastic Fools on Facebook is probably the best way to go.
Perfect. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Watchmen Minute.
And our Facebook page at facebook.com/Watchmen Minute. And come and discuss Dan's eyewear on our Facebook group, the Crime Busters Listener Society.
Yeah, if anyone's selling some eyewear like that, absolutely send me the link. Thanks for having me on, guys. Had a great time.
Absolutely. Thank
glad
you for
I could help you guys out.
Glad we got you on here. And I guess shout out to the Podmates group that both James and I are, I guess, members of. And it's a really great group of people, of fellow podcasters, and all around cool group to be a part of. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've been kind of lurking there for a while, but I'm finally done with uni for the term, so I've starting to branch out and appear on a few, which is I'm really enjoying. So thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah,
thank you.
Our pleasure.
Okay, so this was minute 92, and we'll be back minute 93 with someone else tomorrow. That's it for James, unfortunately. Oh no.
Yeah,
I'm done.
Those long distance flights are.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, finally fly back.
We just don't have it in the budget to keep flying you out every day like this.
Well, the good news is I can catch up on all the movies I'm missing out on the flights. Yeah, right.
Okay, so minute 93 tomorrow, and until then, who watches The Watchmen?
We do.
We do.
1 minute at a time.
Watchmen are over.